everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm Dr. Mike Jansen. I'm a child and adolescent psychologist at the Behavioral Health Center down the street. And this is my colleague. I'll let him introduce himself.
So my name is Cassidy Mike. I'm a child and adolescent therapist at Home Behavioral Health. I've been here about just a little over 9 years and been practicing about 14 years.
So Scott and I have put a presentation together for you tonight based on electronics addiction and working to limit that. First of all, I'm going to talk really fast. One, because we have a lot of slides to cover, but two, also because I know your brain is conditioned to very high stimulation, and if I don't talk fast, right, I won't keep you engaged like you know a screen would if you were playing a video game or something. There is no post-presentation test. The only test there will be tonight is whether you can go the whole hour during the presentation without picking up your own cell phone. All right, so let's get started. Scott and I both work primarily with children and adolescents, and over the last several years what we've noticed increasingly and have given us some increasing concerns are that we're seeing a lot of kids, a lot of adolescents, teenagers using more technology. So we chose this topic because parents are reporting to us that they're having difficulty controlling this. Children's grades are being negatively impacted, as you would imagine. And we felt like it was important to inform parents and caregivers about the dangers related to technology use, as well as to help them have some ideas about how to set limits. I truly believe that this is the next big mental health problem we're facing. My bet is that in the next 20 or 30 years, inpatient facilities for electronics addiction are going to be as prevalent as they are for other types of addictions, drugs, alcohol, so on. And we'll talk a little bit more tonight about why I feel that is. So these are the things that we want to talk about tonight. The objectives are to give you an idea of how the technology has changed in the last few decades, in case you've been paying attention to that. Identify both the positive and negative impacts of technology on society. We're going to look at how the technology is affecting primarily children and adolescent brains. Adult brains as well, but of course, children and adolescent brains are much more malleable. So we'll look at that. We're going to explore the role of parents and caregivers in monitoring exposure, as well as give you some tools to do that.
Okay, so this is a quote, two different quotes they took from the movie Jurassic Park. It came out probably in the 90s. I think I was in middle school. I remember that I had to go do my paper out the next day. So the first quote, if you've ever seen the movie, there's a scientist, before the dinosaurs kind of go crazy and decide to eat everybody, they're deciding if it's a good idea or not to have this park. And one of the scientists, he says to the group and to the park owner, he says, "Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether they could create dinosaurs, they didn't stop to think if they should." A few minutes later in the movie, he says, "If I may, I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You read what others had done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge for yourself, so you don't take any responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had. You patented it, and you packaged it, and you slapped it on a plastic lunchbox." And so I often think of that when I think of technology today. Think about how fast it's grown. I'm 37 years old. I can remember being in middle school when we first had the dial-up internet. And today, it's everywhere. Wi-Fi. And in some ways, I'm thankful for that. We just went overseas, and I don't know where we would have been without Google Translate and for the map of getting around the different cities. But sometimes I think with technology that it came on so fast, so quickly with cell phones and the internet, and some of the other things we'll talk about tonight, did we ever really stop and think, what are we really doing here?
Yeah. One of the other quotes we have up here is by John F. Kennedy, "Technology has no conscience of its own," and that was being said, I'm sure, back in the late 60s or something before he was killed. But you know, this isn't new to us. We understand that technology can be a problem. We recognize that we're the ones that need to control it because it won't control itself.
So before we go into the technology that we have today, let's just quick run through. We'll go from the 1950s to the present. So in the 1950s, some technology that came out then was the credit card. The television was not invented in the 50s, invented before that, but in the 50s is when it became very popular, and then you got to see things like politicians on TV, the space, program in the 70s, obviously we had the Vietnam War. In 1950s, the FCC also authorized CBS Colors television technology as the national standard. So we went from black and white TV to the colors. In the 50s, we also got the transistor radio. McDonald's was taken over by a guy named Ray Kroc, and it started to grow. We got the first computer hard disk and the first copy machine, also some medical technology. In the 60s, we got Valium. We got the first typewriter, the first video game system came out between 66 and 68. The first 8-track player is invented. Believe it or not, the compact disc was also invented in 65. And then in the 70s, we get the VCR. Color television sales exceeded black and white TV sales. Got the first Mr. Coffee company, made the first personal coffee maker. And then in 73, the first cell phone is demonstrated by the company Motorola. And then in 74, we also got Motorola also released a pager. In the 80s, MTV is launched in New York City. You get the first CD player. The first cell phone goes on sale. Anybody want to guess how much the first cell phone cost? Just throwing out a number. $4,000. It's a little bit more than today's iPhone. Then we got Prozac in 1988. And in 1989, high-definition TV. In the 1990s, the World Wide Web, which we'll be talking about, got the digital answering machine. No tapes were needed, if you remember those days. And in 94, 61 million pagers are in use in the United States. 97, we get the first DVD player. 96, we had Web TV. If you're not familiar with that, believe it or not, if you have a smart TV, you're using pretty much the same kind of thing. 98, we got Viagra. And then in 98, the first true digital camera is released by Fuji. Then we're going to jump to the 2000s. In 2001, we get satellite radio, which if you have a newer car, it's probably in your car today. Toyota came out with the first hybrid car in 2003. In 2005, we got YouTube. In 2010, the first iPad is released. 2013, the Apple Store has 900,000 apps. 4 years later, in 2017, the Apple Store now has 2.2 million apps. This is a funny picture. I do remember my parents' cars having these kind of windows. Maybe you do too. Every now and then I'll say to kids in my office, did you roll up your windows? It's raining out. And they look at me weird, like, what does it mean to roll up a window? And the parents just kind of chuckle. So this is a saying, I wonder what my kids are going to tell their kids. It was so rough back in my day, I didn't get a phone until fourth grade, and sometimes the Wi-Fi didn't always work upstairs. I like these two. The one on the left says, the announcer said, don't touch the dial, and the kid says, what's the dial? If you remember the old TVs, you had to click them. And then on the right, a TV show called Antiques Roadshow, and I like the guy who says, I'm afraid the fact that you've got tons of blank tapes for it doesn't make any difference. This is a powerful picture because if you look at it right here, you've got a computer, you've got the old school video camera, you've got a Walkman, you've got a cell phone. And today's cell phone does all of those things. And so when you're carrying around a cell phone, you're capable of doing all of those things. You wouldn't send your kid to school with a backpack with all these things. They wouldn't have room in their backpack for their books or their notebooks. But when you send them to school with that, it's able to do all of those things, at least with a smartphone. This is a picture of, I like this picture. I grew up in the 80s. I love Mario Brothers. I still play with my kids sometimes. And this is a picture taken from a popular video game called Grand Theft Auto. And you can see the difference of what video games were like in the 80s. Mario Brothers shooting little fireballs versus what we have today.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the growing problem here. First of all, perhaps the United States is not the best when it comes to electronics addictions these days. We have a number of Asian companies, countries. I think I said companies last week on TV too, instead of place of country. So we have a number of Asian countries that are ahead of us in the curve when it comes to electronics addiction. So the World Health Organization just last year created a gaming disorder to speak specifically to video gaming. In Japan right now, it's estimated, the last number I saw was about 581,000 teenagers are estimated to have this gaming addiction, which if you look at the population of Japan, represents about it'd be 8%, so about 1 out of every 12 kids is believed to have a gaming addiction in the country of Japan. To talk a little bit about what an addiction looks like, that's what we were talking about. There's certainly a criteria for that, whether, you know, your use of your cell phone 3 hours a day meets the criteria for an addiction is probably debatable, but I want you to have a sense of what an addiction looks like. It certainly would be a continuum. The first thing would be to crave a given item, activity, habit, or substance. Use that item resulting in failure to complete major life tasks. That item creating hazards, perseverating on an addiction when not engaged in it, being irritable and agitated when not engaged in that addiction, needing more of the activity to maintain satisfaction. We'll talk about how our dopamine affects all of that. Longing for the next opportunity to engage in the activity and lying about or hiding the use of the addiction. So these are the major criteria, whether it's gambling, whether it's alcohol, drugs, or electronics. Interestingly, there are a number of different forms, actually, of addiction that we can get through electronics. We'll get to the electronics actually being the addiction itself, but there are six types: the cyber sex and internet porn, the online gambling, shopping or stock trading, the social media, online dating and virtual communication, video gaming, web surfing or database searching, and entertainment viewing. These are all different avenues or routes through which we can develop an electronic addiction. But it's not just the message, it's just not the porn, it's just not the video games, it's also the medium. And the medium itself creates significant problems. First of all, we're talking about a rather unnatural stimulation to our nervous system. We're talking about very high stimulation typically when we're talking about video games. To be honest, I look at television as the lesser of all evils today. And I remember when I was a kid, my parents working diligently to, you know, keep my television time down, thinking it was so bad. And nowadays, I'm like, God, if I get my kids to watch TV for an hour instead of play video games or do something else, maybe I'm ahead. So, both interactive and passive screen time are associated with health issues. That being said, interactive screen time is more dysregulating to our nervous system. We will talk about the one exception to that, but typically the more interactive the screen time, again, like being involved in playing a video game, the more dysregulation it creates versus just watching or viewing a TV show or a movie. And what we're really talking about here is the level of sensory overstimulation, or what we refer to as the cognitive load to our brain, which is the amount of energy needed to process and synthesize information and how that tends to overwhelm our brain and our nervous system. There are a number of technology traps that are used by, you name it, Facebook, social media, video games, and so on. Some of these web designers and video game designers, you know, purposefully create these situations where, they're hooking us and they're keeping us engaged in that electronic medium, because the longer they do that, the more advertisements we see, the more money they make, you know, the more video games we buy, that sort of thing. So the technology traps be mindful of is that of scarcity, which is a snap or status being only available temporarily. So now I've got to increase my usage. Social proof, others are doing it, so I should too. Personalization, you probably get those pop-ups I get pop-ups for fishing tackle, Cabela's, Bass Pro, all the time. Somebody, somehow knows that that's interesting stuff to me. So I can be looking at the weather and those things pop up. And then reciprocity, which is, creating this society, social reciprocity, getting others involved, needing to stay involved yourself as that medium is developed. I often get asked, is this a problem for my child? And if so, how much? And my answer in one sentence is, that if you wonder if this is a problem, simply tell your child that for a day or for a week or for a month, you're going to set the technology aside and then watch their reaction. If you say that to an alcoholic, you know what kind of reaction you're going to get. If you say that to a person who isn't an alcoholic, well, don't expect near as much of a reaction. And it's the same with kids. And when parents report to me, you know, gosh, my kid's throwing a 2-hour meltdown from having to get off the video games or having to get off of the iPad, I start to think to myself, well, you better start thinking that this is a pretty severe problem. Just a little data here on electronics use. And this kind of puts all of us in a little bit of a pickle here. The average adult right now is on their mobile device over 3 hours a day. That's you, me, and everybody else. 59% of adults think their teen is addicted to electronics, and interestingly, 27% of those teenagers agree. Teenagers, meanwhile, think that almost or over a quarter of their parents are addicted to electronics, and adults spend about 70% of adults check their mobile device hourly, 48% feel they must respond immediately, and teenagers even more so. 66% of adults feel their teens spend too much time on electronics. 23% of adults report trying to cut down electronics. Actually, that number kind of scares me. I think it probably should be higher, and I'm wondering if parents are giving in too readily. 36% of adults and 30% of teens report daily arguments about device use. I experienced that myself. I don't know if you do or not. And then the bottom statistic there is kind of scary. 1 out of 16 teens feels that devices are more important to their parents than they are. That's not the message that we want to send to our kids. There are a number of problems, of course, associated with too much screen time, not just how it affects the brain, but our body as well. Obviously, a sedentary lifestyle leads to poor physical health. Vision problems are a big problem as well that we're really overlooking, and we're not, no pun intended, and we're not nearly cognizant enough as that we need to be. Accidents, of course, due to being distracted. I forget, is it what's the Go app?
Pokemon.
Yeah, Pokemon Go, right? We got people walking out, you know, over cliffs and things like that because they're not paying attention. Decreased face-to-face social skills, sleeper deprivation is huge. You know, I've got teenagers reporting that they're spending more time on electronics every week than they are sleeping. And then, of course, we have research that shows us that there are correlations between electronics use and decreased self-esteem, emotional and behavior stability, life satisfaction, and increased anxiety and depression. We'll talk about why some of that is. Obviously, if I'm playing video games or on my iPad, I'm not doing some of the other things I need to, like my schoolwork. School performance goes down. And then interesting, the research is telling us that, I guess we'd expect that, decreased attachment between family members. You know, we just aren't spending enough time with each other because we're spending it on the screen. There are a number of risk factors for an electronics addiction. Some of these are biological / genetic. Many of them, actually. Being male, the younger you are, having any sort of psychiatric disorder or neurological disorder or developmental disorder, chronic medical conditions, a learning disorder, any sort of sensory disorder, a family history of addiction, and then any sort of pregnancy or birth trauma like fetal alcohol or alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder. So let's talk a little bit about how electronics affects the brain. There are actually three primary concerns we have when it comes to too much screen time and how it affects the brain. The first is related to what we know about addiction. So I have a pleasure center in my brain, and when I engage in enjoyable activity, that pleasure center is tickled, if you will, by dopamine. So if you ever wondered why, what that's dope means, now you know, right? Kids always say, no, that's dope, right? Now you know. So I engage in this pleasurable activity. I get this dopamine high, right? It feels good. Now, this is certainly, you know, a normal biological function. So eating creates a dopamine release. procreative activities lead to a dopamine release. But the problem is that addictive behaviors provide a shortcut to this process. When I think about all this, the thought that comes to my mind is that too much of a good thing is not a good thing. Right? So my brain can get too used to too much dopamine too frequently. And then that creates some problems. First of all, this dopamine flooding desensitizes my receptors. It overwhelms them, and they get worn out. So now I need to engage in that activity more in order to get the same rush, same feeling. And of course, that's how addictions progress. We actually know that people with an addictive predisposition have lower baseline levels of dopamine as well as endorphins and norepinephrine. So when they experience that dopamine release, it just feels that much better to them than it would to somebody who has a normal level of dopamine. The problem here is that there are other parts of the brain that, you know, when this happens, end up playing second fiddle, if you will. And the frontal cortex really starts, that's my executive functioning skill brain, that part of my brain really starts to get overridden by my pleasure center. Maybe my frontal cortex says, well, I need to go to work, I need to do get this job done, that sort of thing, and then my pleasure center says, well, no, I'd prefer to play video games because that just feels a lot better. So my decision-making and impulse control are impeded. We know a little bit, via, again, research, what certain activities do to our dopamine level. So raise your hand if you like chocolate. Okay, the reason you like chocolate is because it gives you about a 50% increase in dopamine. Raise your hand if you like snorting cocaine. I'm glad to see nobody raise their hand. That's worth about a 350% increase in dopamine. And if you want to get involved with crystal meth, well, you're looking at about a 1,200% increase in dopamine levels. Adult activities there, 100% increase. And playing video games, who'd like to take a guess? About a 100% increase in your dopamine level from playing video games. Or engaging in any sort of other typical electronic activity. The issue here, again, is that all of this is short-circuiting. You know, I can play electronics for hours and hours and hours and hours on end. I can't eat chocolate for hours and hours and hours on end. I've tried. It didn't go well. So again, you know, we're talking about this flooding. We're talking about my pleasure center just getting worn out and then needing more and more of something to get that same effect. And of course, when we start talking about brain development, you know, it's one thing if, you know, for instance, we introduce alcohol to a 21-year-old brain that's probably within 5 years of full development. And it's something entirely different when we start introducing something that is potentially addictive to a 3-year-old brain, a 6-year-old brain, a 9-year-old brain. You know, those younger brains just don't have the neurobiological ability to handle that stimulation level and to, you know, not become addicted. There's a couple other things that we need to talk about. The other, you know, aside from dopamine and the pleasure center and that creating addiction, you know, my brain, I like to think of my brain when it's born is all these little creeks. And what happens via experience and stimulation is that some of these creeks dry up, but some of these other creeks turn into Mississippi rivers. So we're talking about neural pathway development here. There's a couple of analogies I like to use. One is that of a sled on a snowy hill. You know, Sunday, you could have gone out sledding. I know it stinks that that's the case, but And that first run down the hill, your sled probably wouldn't have gone very fast, right? But as you followed that same path over and over and over, the snow would get packed down, the sled would go faster and faster. Part of the development of my brain is what we refer to as myelination. That's where my brain, I'll use another analogy, right now, if you look at the state of roads in Michigan, right, not very good. And some roads are gravel roads, some roads are paved roads, some roads are highways or interstates. Our brain has finite resources, okay? It can't develop everything that it wants to develop, so it has to choose, you know, which pathways to strengthen, which roads to turn into highways, which roads to let stay gravel. And it's that myelination, which is where this white matter, this white matter that's kind of fatty tissue, creates a sheath around the neural pathways, the neurons. And just like a electrical cord will conduct electricity better if it's coated with rubber or plastic, my neural pathways work faster and work better. The sled goes faster down the hill when these pathways are myelinated. Experience and stimulation is dictating which of those neural pathways get myelinated and which of them don't. And when I start doing, when I start engaging in activities like electronics, well, then certain pathways are more developed. And then if that means I'm not doing other things, that means those neural pathways aren't being developed. And we're seeing some considerable issues here, because the neural pathways that are getting left out in the cold, so to speak, are those that, again, relate more to my prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for executive functioning skills, planning, initiating, organizing, focus and attention, impulse control, emotional regulation, all of these really good things that my brain needs to be able to do. And it's not investing in those pathways, because it's spending time investing in other pathways, primarily those with like hand-eye coordination, things like that. But those aren't going to serve me near as well later in life. Myelin is extremely vulnerable to disruption. Its brain cells that produce cholesterol for proper myelination are damaged by head trauma, environmental stressors, toxins, stress hormones, certain drugs, and overstimulation. And here we're talking primarily about the overstimulation. And then again, what we're talking about, you know, are all these executive functioning skills. But we're also realizing that other parts of the brain related with empathy and reality testing are being compromised. There's some research here that I quote. The internet addiction, some individuals with internet addiction disorder showed some significant myelination abnormalities just in the last, 5 or 6 years here. Functional MRIs are awesome now, because we can look at the brain, we can say, oh yeah, this part's flourishing, this part's wilting, and then we can look at how that might correlate to all these different activities. A couple other research things that I quote. So the top one there, well, I guess, yeah. So back in 2011, a research study was done where the control group didn't do any video gaming. The experimental group did 10 hours of violent video gaming for 1 week, and then none for the next. And then their brains were looked at, and significant differences in their brains were identified. And that was the only difference between the two of them, just after 10 hours of violent video game time. And then a week before they were even assessed. So other brain changes that we've been able to identify: atrophy in gray matter areas, that's again where processing occurs, again primarily in the frontal lobe. Volume loss in the striatum, which is responsible for reward pathways, and the suppression of socially unacceptable impulses. Damage to the insula, which is responsible for capacity for empathy and compassion for others. And then the third concern we have here has to do not just with our brain, but also our autonomic nervous system. So my autonomic nervous system, as part of my central nervous system, is designed to determine just how revved up or relaxed I need to be based on environmental cues. Right? The analogy now that I've used for years is that if I'm in Yellowstone National Park and I'm walking through the mountains taking in the beauty around me, right, I'm in this very relaxed, what we would call parasympathetic state, until I come over a little hill and there's a mother grizzly bear and three cubs 20 feet in front of me. And now my system goes into this revved up, what we call sympathetic state, essentially your fight or flight response. All right. When we digitally stimulate our brain, it revs up our system. It puts our autonomic nervous system into this revved up state. Chemically, electrically, mechanically, physiologically. Some of the things that happen: increased heart rate, increased blood pressure. My digestive system slows down. Basically, my body says, I mean, this is all evolutionary. Basically, my body says, if I'm about ready to become a bear's lunch, no use digesting my own. So the blood flow, the oxygen, the energy goes to different parts of my body. So we're creating my 8-year-old. If you watch him play video games, he's pushing the button to go up and down, but he's jumping up and down too. And he's doing that, and my wife's smiling, she knows. He broke a bed because he was doing that. He was bouncing on the bed so hard, you know. He gets revved up, right? And then it's like, okay guys, it's bedtime, you know. Or, hey, okay guys, why don't you play nicely together for a while, you know. No. So this is creating this revved up state for us. Now, this hyperarousal creates chronic stress, which results in mood dysregulation, increased, like I said, increased blood pressure, heart rate, elevated cortisol. Cortisol is one of my stress hormones. When I get revved up, stress hormones get dumped into my bloodstream, so I can fight the bear harder or fast, you know, I can run away faster, those sorts of things. Again, this is all biological, it's all evolutionary. But the problem is that my body's still programmed to deal with bears and not electronics. And decreased immune system functioning, and delayed ability or decreased ability to delay gratification, as well as decreased attention and memory learning, disturbed sleep, all these things. So those are the three primary things that we're worried about. I put up here, stay tuned, because in 2013, this absolutely huge study known as the Allison Brain Cognitive Development Study was started. Initially looking at how alcohol, drug use, that sort of thing, prenatally affects children, adolescents, teenagers, adults. And then just recently they decided, well, we're going to look at also how sports, video games, social media, sleep patterns, and smoking affect brain development. We're starting to get a little trickle of research from this already, but in the next, I would say, 4 or 5 years, we're going to have a much better understanding of exactly what kinds of issues we're dealing with, what kinds of differences within the brain we're having because of this very thorough study that's being conducted. So, for just the menial price of $3 million, or $300 million. So, I always ask the question, well, does my kid play a lot of electronics because they have ADHD? Or do they have ADHD because they play a lot of electronics? Those things are highly correlated. There are other things that are highly correlated. Basically, it's a chicken or egg kind of question. I have this slinky theory of life, which simply says that A creates B, creates C, creates D, which probably creates more or less of A, and then B, and then D, and then C. And that's how life works. So much of life is recursive, and this is recursive too. Maybe kids with ADHD need more stimulation to pay attention, so they start playing video games, and then of course their brain loves that, so they crave it more. And then their brain is put in a position where it doesn't have to focus and pay attention in the absence of stimulation, so it just perpetuates the problem, right? I truly believe that we are creating ADHD brains. Our brains are conditioned these days to such high stimulation, so early, so frequently, Actually, I love to fish, and I worry that my boys are going to be able to go out fishing and stare at a bobber for even 10 or 15 minutes, you know, without something happening to it and staying and being able to stay engaged. I just don't see that happening. And then when I see two-year-olds walk into my office with the cell phones, and I think, wow, what's going to happen with that generation and then that generation's children and so on. And I feel like we're on a really slippery slope here. And that's why we're here tonight, because I feel like we need to draw the line. This chicken or egg idea here is promoted by Dr. Victoria Dunkley. She, I mentioned her simply because she is recommending that we consider something known as electronic screen syndrome. She would be one of the leading experts that's looking into this. She's developed a list of criteria, the symptoms that we'd be looking for. I see, gosh, if I don't see a dozen kids, you know, walk through my office door, you know, with this kind of presentation weekly, it's a surprise. Mood issues, so dysregulated mood, low frustration tolerance, very problematic. Disorganized behavior, you know, oppositional behaviors, poor sportsmanship, social immaturity, poor eye contact, sleep problems, learning difficulties. Certainly all these things can be a function of some other disorder, but I can't wonder myself if the electronic use, the excessive electronic use that oftentimes gets reported to me, isn't a function of this. Very common, more common for parents to report to me that they're child adolescent is spending somewhere between 30 and 40 hours a week on a screen versus 10 or 15 hours a week. Now, my hope would be is that the kids I'm not seeing are spending 10 or 15 hours, but I think I know otherwise. Dr. Dunkley has kind of grabbed onto this diagnosis. She's been treating it. Her experience is that it can take 3 to 4 weeks or even longer to see these problems wane once you go cold turkey on this. Sometimes the symptoms return with reintroduction. There's a question of whether electronics can be reintroduced. And then again, I listed some of the vulnerability factors there that I've already mentioned before. So, okay.
So the wireless internet, the wireless industry's impact on America's economy is, it employs about just under 5 million Americans a year, and it brings in about $500 billion annually to America's economy. So big business. I like the first one up here. It says mobile phones have 18 times more bacteria than toilet handles. Pretty nasty. Don't share your phone. And in Japan, 90% of mobile phones are waterproof because youngsters even want to use them in the shower. Let's see here. 47% of U.S. smartphone owners say their smartphone is something they can't live without. 61% of Americans say they text while they're driving. And then 77% of Americans, adults, now own a smartphone as of January of last year. That's up 36% from February of 2011. 15 to 18-year-olds are reported to spend an average of almost 2 hours each day sending text messages. Kids between 11 and 14 spend an average of an hour and 13 minutes sending text messages. 65% of high school students use their cell phone in school. 1/4 of all text messages sent by teens are done so during the school hours, class hours. Teens send and receive 5 times more text messages per day than adults. So who has cell phones? 51% of 12-year-olds, and the average age today in America of kids who get their, when they first get their first cell phone is 12 years old. 53% of 13-year-olds have them, 72% of 14-year-olds, and so on. So you can see the numbers go up. So again, 12 is the average age when they get them. 56% of kids ages 8 to 12 have a cell phone today. 37% of teenagers ages 13 to 17 have access to a smartphone, and 88% of teenagers ages 13 to 17 have access to just a normal cell phone. And 91% of teens go online from a mobile device at least occasionally. How do they use their cell phone? The number one thing that people use their cell phone is for checking the time. Number two is sending text messages. What are the benefits of cell phones? Because there's benefits, right? You get to call, you never miss a call. as long as your cell phone's charged, and charging stations are everywhere. Parents are able to track where the kids are at. I think there's a level of safety to it, right? You got to be picked up from something. Somebody forgot to drop you off back in the day. I'd have to go get 35 cents and make a phone call. Today, you can just borrow somebody's phone. And you're able to stay in touch with your kids. And you can also teach them how to be responsible with cell phones. What are the negatives of cell phones? Well, cheating at school, 35% of teens with cell phones admitted cheating at least once with their phone. There's the cost with it. Cell phones can be very distracting from more important events in a child's life, such as studying, which they believe that's important, doing homework, or crossing the street. Mike mentioned that with the Pokemon game. Driving while texting on the phone, and then there's sexting. I also noticed, and this is one of my pet peeves, I get kids in my office, it happens at least once a day, and they come in the door, I greet them, well, hi, I'm Mr. Scott, nice to meet you, or hey, buddy, good to see you again, and they've got their head down with the, right in the phone, and I stop them, I say, oh, no, that's not how we do things. What are some other negatives? Talks a little bit about, says the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unwanted Pregnancy reports 1 in 5 teenage girls between the ages of 13 to 16 year olds say they have electronically sent or posted online semi-nude or nude photos of themselves. So that's sending naked pictures of themselves, or maybe they send it to somebody and it gets shared.
If you're not familiar with what FOMO stands for, it stands for the fear of missing out. The idea here is that I need to have my cell phone on me all the time, because if a friend texts me or Snapchats me or whatever, I need to respond immediately. And if I don't, I'm out of the loop. Right, my friend thinks I'm dissing them or whatever. So moderate cell phone users, you know, again, we can look at cortisol levels related to all this and get a really good idea of our stress response. Moderate cell phone users show an increase in cortisol levels and an anxiety response literally within 25 minutes of being without their cell phone. Heavy cell phone users, within 10 minutes, they are going into a physiologically anxious, stressed out state because they don't have their cell phone.
So the question we get asked, Mike, I'm sure you too, is when is the right time for me to get my kid a cell phone? So it really is no right age. Again, 12 is the average. And there's really, I say to the parents, what's your reasoning? There really is no rush to it. Parents can keep the pace reasonable and developmentally appropriate and allow their kids to use technologies that make sense while granting them access technologies. So you can buy a phone, and it doesn't have to be all about the internet. You can limit. You can get some cell phones today. It could just be a flip phone. I've seen some parents do that, or caregivers. And so it doesn't have to have access you don't have to have a data plan. Go to the next one, Mike.
Yeah.
Okay. So some checklist is, how independent are your kids? And do your children need to be in touch for safety reasons or social ones? How responsible are they? Can they get behind the concepts of limits for minutes talked and apps downloaded? What's going to happen when you say, hey, I want to check your phone? What kind of reaction are you going to get from them? Oftentimes, I'll get the kids or the teens to say, it's my phone, you can't look at it. Do you want to add all the expense of the new data plans? You know, you can add on to a family, and it might not be that much more, but there's still a cost to it. Can they be trusted during class? Are they going to pull this out? Is this going to become a problem? Kids are already today have iPads or computers often they're using at school. This is another thing. So what can parents do about cell phones? You can set guidelines, and I would do that right away. I'd say, okay, you've got your cell phone. Here's our expectations. Write up a contract. I've got a handout today where you can have a contract and say, let's both agree ahead of time. Here's what we're going to do. Here's when you can use your phone. Here's what you can use your phone for. Be clear on both ends. You can teach cell phone etiquette. I don't know how much of that exists, but definitely there. Again, you can have a contract. Limit them when they can use it. Maybe say, you know, we're not going to allow it at school, something along those lines. My final thoughts on cell phones are, remember that when you hand your kids a smartphone today, you're giving them a powerful communication and production tool. Remember the picture I showed you earlier with all the things that a smartphone can do? It can record, it can take pictures, it can send pictures, depending on your plan. You can go on the internet, you can make calls. And so we have to remember that we're still the parents, and it's our job to say, no, not yet, if we feel that they're not ready.
Talking a little about social media real quickly here. I think some of you are aware of the dangers. My greatest concern about social media is this idea that kids have these days that they need to put themselves out there to be judged. Here I am, like me or not, right? And then I often see identities and self-esteem get wrapped up into that, right? Huge concern. Just this whole idea that my value comes from how other people judge me is a problem, but certainly there are other issues as well. YouTube, Instagram, Snapchat—you know, these are all the most popular things. And I'm assuming most of you are aware of some of these things that get embedded now in YouTube videos, the challenges, that sort of thing. Very problematic. You know, you got your kid watching some cute little YouTube video, and the next thing you know, somebody's on there, you know, telling them to shoot their mother or something. These kinds of things, you know. You know about the heat Facebook has taken with the whole shooting that happened in New Zealand. These kinds of things are just so problematic. Instagram, Snapchat, I don't know a whole lot about those, but I do know that some of them, like, you know, it's here 1 second, it's gone the other. Where's the ability then to supervise or monitor what's going on, right? It's just not there. So all these things represent so many different dangers. Let's skip this one here. I also, you know, this makes the point here that, you know, people have these social connections via Facebook and so on. And while I do feel that they create benefit, I mean, it's nice to get on Facebook and see family members and pictures and things like that. That's great. I also feel that it really creates this rather superficial relationship at times versus a deep, significant, profound, more face-to-face, connected, physically connected relationship. I'm not going to bash it completely because some kids can only operate on that superficial level. I work with a lot of kids with like Asperger's disorder and things like that, and their only friends are friends they play via, you know, Xbox, via the internet, or Facebook with, and things like that. So there is potentially some benefit, but I see that replacing, just the connection that we all really need. With regard to tablets, tablet use is increasing. The real problem with all this stuff, I believe, is when all of this went mobile. You know, it was one thing for me to sit home on the computer and do all this, but now I can be anywhere doing anything, and I'm doing this. And it was, what, just 2007, I think, when the iPhone came out and really all of this went mobile. We're talking 12 years, just 12 years. And we look at how, a couple of years ago, I went to the University of Michigan, and a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to go back for a conference. And I thought, well, I'm going to take this time to see what's changed in 25 years. And the same kids are there. You know, you got the kids wearing the old Canvas Converse, you got the frat kids, you got the computer geeks, you know. They're all there. But what struck me was I'm walking down the sidewalk and I passed like 10 or 12 people in a row that were looking at their cell phones. Right? I went to the Union, they have a Starbucks there now, that's the other thing that changed. Got sophomores in college buying $5 lattes. But everybody had a computer out. Everybody had a mobile device, right? And some of them were studying, but some of them were just social media, socializing, that sort of thing. You know, and of course, when I was there, I had to stand in line for hours to wait for a computer at the computer center, right? So that's what really struck me. When it comes to internet use, you know, monitoring that, supervising that is again so difficult. It's easy to say that you're 18 when you're not to access sites, or that you've read and agreed to the terms. That's not the case. Virtually all teens are going online now between the ages of 12 and 17. The use is just so pervasive. 45% of teens actually say that they're online almost constantly. Now, I don't know how that could be the case, especially if they're in school. But maybe these are the kids who are doing homeschooling online. I don't know. And again, Scott and I both don't want to bash, you know, technology and the internet, because we do believe that there are benefits. Some of the benefits of the internet are listed here. I love the fact that I can literally Google anything. You know, I can ask the computer anything and get an answer. You know, I can YouTube how to change the you know, headlight on a 2012 Chevy Traverse and watch a 3-minute YouTube video and save $80 that my mechanic wanted to charge me, right? So again, great benefits, but we also, you know, I'm not sure we recognize the risks and the costs, which would be online bullying, online predators. You wouldn't believe this, but I've had 9 and 10 year olds getting online, looking to get into relationships with people online, physical relationships with people online. Scary stuff. Less face-to-face interaction, decreased time spent doing all the other things that we should be doing. Again, the internet, of course, has exploded in the last 10 or 15 years. I'm getting low on time. So,
and Mike, while you're looking for that, just something to think about. If you have Wi-Fi in your home, you know, wireless internet, in the United States, the average home that has Wi-Fi has just over 9 devices that can connect to it. So in my home, I thought, oh man, we're way below that average. But when I started to think about it and I added up, you have your cell phones, you have your video game systems, you have your televisions, you have your DVD players, you have your printer, all these, your computer maybe, your laptop, all these other things that can connect. And what we have found, at least I've found, my contributor to appearance, is that they find out, oh my gosh, so many different things in my home can connect to the internet. It's not just my cell phone and my computer.
Yeah. When it comes to the internet too, social media, you know, you're probably all aware of the issues that we can have with cyberbullying. That top statistic there is just scary. Only 5% of middle school students say they would tell their parents if they were being cyberbullied. So I'd be asking, maybe you won't get the truth, but maybe you will, and you probably have a better chance of getting the truth than if you don't ask. When it comes to maintaining healthy digital world friendships, I believe this is in your handout. Everything that we gave you in the PowerPoint presentation handouts relates to the interventions, right? So that you go home with things that you can do. But these are what need to happen. Your kids need to understand the difference between an online and offline friend. They need to maintain clear boundaries via privacy settings. They have to understand popularity is not measured by likes. They need to identify when exclusion is occurring. Be thoughtful and safe with romantic online relationships. My wife and I met on eHarmony, so I'm not sure that I proved that one. But averting online conflicts and identifying online cruelty and responding accordingly. We need to teach our children about internet safety when it comes to passwords, making new friends. Again, kids are so used to this technology, they just don't recognize the risks involved. They're just naive to it. They go about using it, and then when something bad goes wrong, we've got a big problem. So work to protect your child online. Spend time with them exploring the internet. Teach them about cyberbullying. Educate them about their digital footprint. And then keep the computer in a common area so that you know what's going on. Signs of online troubles, turning off the computer. There's a term, parent over shoulder, POS. I don't know if you. I thought PLS meant something else. I don't know about you. That's how teens let their person they're communicating with know that they can't keep talking about whatever they were talking about, right? I have kids who sneak their computers into their bedroom to be online all night. I can tell you a story about my own 10-year-old if you want to hear it after we're done. But all these things could be problems here. We need to protect our kids. You protect them by not letting them play in the road. You need to protect them from all of this as well. We give you some very good internet accountability and filtering apps, programs. Those are in your handout. All right. Scott?
So just something to think about on cell phones. For every 3 searches that are done, one of those are, one out of every 3 are used to search for adult material pornography. Just something to think about. So TVs, I think that we're moving more towards streaming. So we're talking like different, you know, Netflix. We're talking about like YouTube TV. It's a great program app. I have it at home. Works very well. It's a lot cheaper than cable. But TV is still a very powerful and a very prevalent thing in homes. We have two TVs in our homes. In the United States, you can see the statistics right here that fewer than 1% of the families in the United States do not have a TV. Half of the families in the United States have three or more. By the time the average person reaches age 70, he or she will spend the equivalent of 7 to 10 years of their life watching television. Children watch 25 hours of TV a week or 3.5 hours a day. I think that number will go down as we look at people using more like their tablets and so on to watch programs. Children who watch a lot of TV are likely to have lower grades in school, read fewer books, exercise less, and be overweight. Television is a powerful teacher of children, adolescents, and teens. Something to ask yourself is today, how are family values portrayed on television? You can think back to your own childhood, what shows on there did you watch, what's on today? These are the different ratings. You can go online, look these up, and see what they mean. I have one of these in my office. It talks about what is, you know, TVPG mean. You know, your TV, usually when the program comes on, it should be on. There's definitely potentials to it. I mean, it's a fairly inexpensive form of entertainment. It's been an effective tool in mass media, making people aware of a wide range of human problems, ranging from pollution to homelessness and so on. It can be a learning tool, PBS, some different programs. The negatives are that the recently completed 3-year National Television Violence Study found the following. Nearly 2/3 of all programming contain violence. Children's shows contain the most violence. Portrayals of violence are usually glamorized, and perpetrators often go unpunished. So what can you do as parents? Active parenting can ensure that children have a positive experience with television by viewing the programs with your kids, asking them, hey, what did we just watch? What did you see? What did you learn from that? Placing limits on the amount of TV that they view and that they watch. Remember, they're in front of screens, and especially as they get older. They're on their laptops at school. They're on their iPads. They're on their phones. All these different screens, and now they're in front of TV. Going back to what I talked about with a contract or something, with a cell phone, make very specific rules about when children can and cannot watch television. Mom, I still haven't forgiven you that after on school nights I can watch any TV after the 7 o'clock, and they stuck to that, let me tell you guys. Limit maybe viewing to 1 to 2 hours per day at most, and don't allow channel surfing, only planned viewing. So maybe make a list of saying, here's the programs that we allow. Keep the TV off during family meal times. And just, you know, no TV, maybe I usually recommend, I don't know about you, Mike, but no electronic use 30 minutes before bedtime. It's pretty common.
Should be reading.
Finish it up.
All right. We've got about 15 more slides. I'm thinking about 10 more minutes. You're not going to hurt Mike Meyer Scott's feelings if you do leave, if you have to go home. We understand that. So let's talk a little bit about video games. I understand that colleges are now giving scholarships for gaming, right? When the whole Bass tournament thing came out and colleges were giving scholarships to be on a Bass team and Bass Fish, I thought, oh, that's awesome. But when they came out with this, I'm like, oh boy, here we go. I'm not surprised. What I am surprised by is that the average age of a gamer is 37. That seems a little high to me. But then I think back to all my buddies, back in the 80s and 90s who were spending 30, 40, 50 hours a week playing video games instead of going to class in college. So, scary statistic. The average girl in elementary or middle school, 5.5 hours a week of video game time. The average boy, 13 hours. So you throw 13 hours of video game time on top of 20 hours of TV time on top of an hour a day of texting, and pretty soon you're up to that 40 hours I was talking about. And of course, these video games, reiterating that, these video games are not the video games of the 70s or 80s, right? I started with that ping pong game. That was like the first one, you know, and I thought that was awesome. And then Atari 2600 came out, and I'm like, whoa, this blows me away, you know? And now I was just like, I don't even, you know. 90% of teens say their parents never check the video game ratings before they rent or buy. I have parents reporting to me that their 6-year-old is playing Grand Theft Auto where you shoot police officers, deal drugs, and rape women. And I think to myself, you know what? I'm not sure that's a really good idea, you know? And then this kid's emotionally dysregulated, anxious, whatever else. I'm thinking, gosh, you know, what are you teaching this kid about what normalcy in life is, right? Again, there can be some benefits to video games. You know, I play them on occasion with my own children. But the negatives far outweigh it, I believe. Social isolation, decreased school performance, decreased physical health, all these things, you know, just from a sedentary lifetime, lifestyle. The chili sauce paradigm, you know, if you're familiar with the Milgram study back in the 60s, this is just really interesting. If you need to leave, fine, but hopefully you'll find this interesting. Milgram wanted to study how people would listen to authority, right? This is a decade or so after all the trials related to the Holocaust and all the Nazi officers being tried. And many of them gave the defense of, well, I was just following orders. So Milgram thought, well, I'm going to do a study to see just how much people will follow orders. And he devised the research protocol whereby his participant had to give an electric shock to somebody if they didn't answer a question right. And then there was an authority figure, you know, insisting that that person do that, even though the person getting shocked was, like, literally screaming out in pain or whatever, right? And the research study showed that 2/3 of all people went to the very maximum level of shock to the person being shocked with that authority figure standing over them, telling them that they had to do it, all right? Now, we can't shock people anymore. That's a good thing. But somebody along the line came up with this great idea. Well, let's use chili sauce. So some kids were taken, and again, the control didn't play violent video games. The experimental group did, right? And then the kids were told, okay, well, we're going to create a dinner for some other people, and they don't really like hot stuff, all right? But so here's some chili sauce. Go ahead and put as much into it as you want to. The kids who played the violent video games dispensed twice as much chili sauce to the people who didn't want chili sauce, right? Again, I'm not going to connect that to, you know, a kid playing a violent video game and then becoming a school shooter or whatever. But it does increase aggression. It ramps us up. It puts us into that sympathetic state. And that aggression, you know, may not be carried out in that way, but I think that kid's going to be more likely to punch somebody on the playground or something like that. So violent video games, if you know, people will tell you, you know, people like to say, oh, the research is mixed. Yeah, we don't know, you know. No, we do. Violent video games increase aggression. These are just, again, related to some of the things we've already talked about. My brain gets addicted to them, right? Now I need to do them. Video games, what I see is, it is the coping mechanism du jour. If I have a kid with anxiety or depression, they're doing poorly in school, they turn to their video games. It takes them to a whole different world. You know, they can play the video games for hours and hours on end, and all their cares and worries go away. Of course, their grades continue to plummet as their schoolwork doesn't get done, right? And it creates this very vicious cycle again of using a coping mechanism too much, becoming addicted to it, not solving the problems in my life, and then needing more of that coping mechanism to manage the increased problems that I have in my life. And this is how, you know, I have kids that get up to 70, 80 hours a week of video game time. Tips for parents, those are in your handouts again. Check the ratings, make sure the games are appropriate, all these kinds of things. No video games in the bedroom, homework first. All right, so we talked about all the different forms of electronics. Let's talk about just how to manage screen time in general. First, recognize legitimate concerns. Okay, so when I see inactivation on parents' parts, it's because of some concerns they have. First, they're concerned that it's going to be really difficult to remove the screens from their lives. Because maybe their children are going to have a really adverse reaction to that. That's a situation where the tail's wagging the dog. That's oftentimes a situation where the child is blackmailing the parent to get what they want with poor behavior. So the parent saying, you do your schoolwork, you can play video games, the kid says to the parent, you let me play video games or I'm going to throw a tantrum and make your life a living hell. Right? If you find yourself in that situation as a parent, get out of it as quickly as you can. And if you need help, get it. As parents, yeah, you know, we know our kids like them, right? So we might have some guilt about taking them away. They're pleasurable. I don't want to take something enjoyable away. But again, I've got to limit that. Because again, if my kid gets too much of a dopamine rush from it, you know, there are some serious problems. We have our own difficulty with getting things done. You know, let's face it, electronics is a good babysitter. Put my kid on it for an hour, don't have to worry about him. I can make dinner, I can mow the lawn, whatever. That being said, you know, maybe the kid can be outside playing too as well you're mowing the lawn. Number five, huge, what others will think. My boys last summer came to us and said, hey, Mom and Dad, we'd like an Xbox. So-and-so has an Xbox. So-and-so also has an Xbox. We've just got this old Wii game, right? Oh, here we go, right? So we actually put up a fight. And actually, you know, what we said was, well, you can buy a couple extra games for the Wii, or we can get this Xbox, you know, and it costs 10 times more. And we talked them into sticking with the Wii. They got a few extra games that are new. Now they're playing those, and everything's hunky-dory. But boy, you know, the whole battle of, you know, what their friends are going to think, you know, was a big issue. Everybody in my subdivision knows I'm a pediatric psychologist, and I oftentimes think that parents don't want to interact with me because they're afraid that I'm always judging them, right, about how they're parenting. I mean, I'm on record with much to my wife's chagrin, I'm on record in my neighborhood, and let everybody know, in loco parentis, in your absence, I'm going to parent your child, you know? So if you don't want me to, you better be around. But that's, you know, it's not just the kids, it's the parents. You know, I have to worry about what other parents, you know, think about me, you know, well, because I'm not giving my kid an Xbox, that sort of thing. That's a problem. And then there's this concern about our kids falling behind technologically. Certainly technology is going to be huge. It's very possible that my own children could have a job in the field of technology someday. I don't want them to not know what a cell phone is or how to use it, those kinds of things. But again, I can't be so worried that they're going to fall behind that I give them too much of that exposure. Setting greater limits on screen time. Do this. If your child is more symptomatic, the more severe any given symptom is, the more risk factors your child has that we talked about earlier. The younger your child is, you know, the American Pediatric Association says no electronics before age 2, right? Maybe a TV show, maybe, but otherwise none, right? And then after that, it shouldn't be probably more than an hour a day until at least age 6, 7, 8. And then maybe you start thinking, well, maybe a couple hours a day, you know, for older kids. But again, I'd really be pushing more TV, more educational things than the video games and everything else. I mentioned how the interactive electronics is more problematic to our nervous system. That is the case. So pushing for more passive kinds of electronics is useful. The only exception to that, interestingly, is that the people who are more interactive on social media actually have less depression and anxiety because they're engaged and they're involved. And the more passive receivers of Facebook, other social media kinds of materials end up doing what we call compare and despair, right? Because, I mean, everybody puts all the great, wonderful stuff on Facebook, right? Here we are on vacation. You know, here the kids are happy on the ride. You know, did anybody ever see the picture? Here's my kid throwing a tantrum in the restaurant because, you know, they ran out of barbecue sauce for their chicken nuggets? No, right? So, you know, one of the other problems with social media, I didn't mention, is that we expose ourselves to this, and then we think, oh my God, how great is everybody else's life, and how sucky is mine, right? Compare and despair. Now, when people are active in that, though, and they're putting their own pictures on and sharing how wonderful their life is, then that does tend to assuage any sort of anxiety, depression. But that would be the only exception. And when things aren't working, you know, if things aren't working, your child's emotionally dysregulated, they're doing poorly in school, any of those kinds of things, just try cutting out the electronics and see what happens. You'd probably be amazed at the difference that would make. Positive parents. Create planned, unplugged spaces, recognize their own device, use settings. Don't ever underestimate the power of modeling. Model that civility on online correspondence. Create clear, defined boundaries related to technology. Model respect for other people's boundaries. Use technology to make a positive difference in the world. Monitor. But more importantly, mentor. Teach the appropriate use of electronics. Don't just limit it, teach its use. And then recognize that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If I could retire, if I had a dime for every parent who, after you know, they come to my office and they you know tell me about all these problems, you know, say to themselves, "Gosh, if I'd have known this was going to be such an issue, I wouldn't have started it all in the first place," right? So, if we work to limit, you know, my kids are never going to ask for something that they're not aware of. None of them has ever asked for any like a knife to cut blubber off a whale. You know, I think there's some sort of knife you could get, right? Why? Because they don't do that, right? They're not exposed to that. I know that's a really bizarre example, but if I protect my kids from all of this, they don't know what they're missing. If they don't know what they're missing, it can't become a problem for them. Make a habit of checking your cell phone less frequently. Share expectations of others about how often you're going to do that. Sign as a notification. Use an alarm. One of the things I didn't touch on was EMF, the electric magnetic field that your cell phone and other devices create. We have some research. It's possible that future research is going to really suggest that it's much more of a problem than we ever thought. So I would encourage you to not, you know, put your cell phone in a different room when you sleep, that sort of thing. Designate electronics-free places. Again, this is in your handouts. Pretty self-explanatory. Not during meal times. No double screening. TV, cell phone, TV, iPad, that sort of thing. Take it out during family fun nights. No screens in the car, that sort of thing. And then what do we do in its place? Imagine 40 years ago, 50 years ago, when kids didn't have video games. What the heck did they do, right? I mean, I don't know. Who knows? You know, I'm only 33, so. Well, they got outside, and they played baseball, things like that, right? So we promote fresh air, nature, sunlight, movement, exercise, free play, deep sleep, clean diet, creativity, Legos versus Minecraft. Research shows us that, again, go back to the neural pathways, when it's 3D, three-dimensional, when I'm manipulating it versus watching it on a screen, my brain gets far more benefit from that. Okay. Mindfulness, meditation, human touch, empathy, love, all good stuff. There's some other useful resources, and that brings us to our last slide.
So just something to think about before you leave is that what Mike and I have tried to get across to you and I just asked. There's definitely an addiction potential. It does. Electronics do impact your brain. Doesn't mean everybody's going to be addicted to them. And I think first we have to ask ourselves as parents or caregivers, what am I modeling to my kids? Because kids walk in our footsteps. I learned that from a parent. That they see us and they look towards us. So what are we modeling? And Mike talked about how much time that we use. And then in turn, what are our kids doing? I mean, are they seeing that we're on our phones and our electronics for 3 hours a day? Do they see that we're on our phone during family time instead of going outside and playing with them, that we are instead too busy on our own screens? When I was 17, we were going to get a second car, and it was this awesome Mercedes-Benz. I don't know how many miles it had on it, probably in the hundreds of thousands. And it was so cool. It had the dark tinted windows, and it had the loud sound system. And I saw myself at 17 pulling up at Hound High, where I went to high school, playing the loud music, driving the cool car, and I thought, yeah, this is the car we gotta get. But unfortunately, the story doesn't end like that. We got a Honda with the non-tinted windows and the no sunroof, and the sound system was pretty average. And so when you go and you decide that it's time to get your kids some type of electronic, maybe be a phone, a tablet, you don't have to get them the Mercedes-Benz of it. Teach them how to use the basic one. Teach them how to use the calling part of it first. Teach them how to use how to text. And then let them get into the other things. Because whether it's a tablet, or it's a PlayStation 4, or it's a cell phone, or it's a Samsung, or a TV, a smart TV, these things can do so many different things, more things than I even know how to do with my TV or my cell phone. And kids find a way to get to them, and teens do too. And so we have to teach them how to use these devices first, before we give them the Mercedes-Benz with the nice options.
We'd like to thank you for all of your time. We're about 20 minutes over. That being said, if you'd like to stay and ask questions, Scott and I, I'll stay until 7:30. Scott will stay until 12. So any questions any of you might have? I know there's a lot of information very quickly, a lot to digest. I think in the handouts we've given you the relevant information as it relates to what you need to do as a parent. I hope we haven't scared you too much with how much of a problem this is potentially or will be in the future. But maybe it is good that we're a little afraid. So maybe it'll keep us more vigilant. Yes?
Are you available to do these presentations to
your for the right fee. Yeah, I suppose so. We have to talk about that with our clinical manager. We'll see what she said. Yeah, we can go on the road.
Mike sleeps on the couch.
Other questions? Yes?
We're considering now these little trouble kids. It's a little off on this thing, but when you consider all these trouble kids, especially involved with like the school shootings and so on like that, is and a lot of times they tie into the fact that, you know, they were loners and they played video games and all that kind of stuff. But we don't seem to be, as a society, be able to do anything about limiting the content of these video games.
Right.
Even though we know what bad things they do.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, the unfortunate reality is that, it really comes down to the parent limiting that. Yeah, but then the other part of all that is that, you know, so often when by the time parents get to me, they are completely disempowered. It's again a matter of they should have been here 5 years ago and working to prevent this instead of trying to cure it. It varies. Adam Lanza had an electronics addiction. He had, he had Asperger's disorder. There's a lot of other things going on. Those are certainly the exceptions, but enough of those exceptions, I don't know about you, but it really gets old to me. I'm just so tired of the violence in the world. And in my mind, anything that we can do to limit the violence, there's some crazy number of literally tens of or hundreds of thousands of violent acts that kids see by the time they're 18, My wife and I held off on showing our boys The Lion King until like just last year when they were like 8 and 10 years old, because I'm like, you know what? Yeah, it's a cartoon, it's Disney or whatever it is, Pixar or whatever, but it shows, an uncle of The Lion King killing the dad. And I'm like, I don't want to expose my children to that until they're older, until they can understand that. I remember being like 16 or 18 and some Sylvester Stallone movie like Cobra or something coming out. Can't remember exactly what, maybe that's it. And there, like, it was a new record because like there were 68 killings in that movie. And now I'm like, 68? Some of these movies had that within the first 10 minutes, And then we wonder why our society is so much more violent, so much more aggressive. If I'm going to be a pilot, right? I go to flight training. I go to flight school. They put me in a simulator, right? They don't put me in a plane and say, "Okay, yeah, take off and land." No, they put me in a flight simulator. That's like a video game. and I practice, right? And then I think, okay, well, you know, what are we doing when we give kids video, violent video games, you know? Well, they're practicing. And again, maybe they aren't going to act that out, but we can't downplay the physiological, autonomic, automatic response our body has to doing that activity, even though it's not real, even though it's on the screen. It still revs us up, especially the younger brains. You know, the problem with the 6-year-old brain and the 26-year-old brain, and maybe even the 16-year-old brain, is that the 6-year-old brain does not distinguish between reality and non-reality, right? And if you know anything about memory, and what we refer to as implicit and explicit memory. Explicit memory is just the facts. The capital of Michigan is Lansing. That gets stored in my temporal lobe in my thinking brain. Implicit memory is emotion-laden memory. All right, that gets stored in my limbic system, right, my feeling brain. And then its job, you know, part of my limbic system's job is to protect me, right? It remembers these things, these scary things, these frightful things, and then it wants to remind me of them to keep me safe. Well, I appreciate that, right? And it's somewhat functional. You know, we have an anxiety epidemic with kids these days because the world is so scary, partly because, you know, the news is showing us this plane that crashed and that hurricane, and then all the violence that's going on, right, in video games and otherwise, right? A 16-year-old brain, a 26-year-old brain can watch a scary movie, and those memories get stored in the temporal lobes. And it's just fact, because I know it's not real. A 6-year-old brain puts it into the limbic system because it sees it and it thinks it's real, right? And then, again, you know, we're dealing with a completely different physiological and psychological response. Good question, thank you. Other questions? Okay, well, we thank you for your time. We hope you found it helpful. Scott and I, you know, just down the road at the Behavioral Health Center, if you need, you know, if you want to contact either one of us about any of this, or just reach out to us. So, Kathy will answer the phone for you.